Welcome to our show today. This is our first segment of a two-segment show taking about an hour. We're continuing our discussion about evidence that points in a different direction from the NICNT, that's the New International Commentary of the New Testament, which is the work that we are reviewing. We finished our review, and now we're pointing to evidence that disagrees with that commentary. So today we're going to take up a couple of points. The first one we're going to take up is going to be Acts 24:5, which we mentioned in the Pauline study, and that is the sect of the Nazarenes. We're going to look at that in a little more detail. It's going to get its own show, and it's going to be more than one show. It's that much information about it. Today, we're just going to cover some highlights just so that we can make the case about the discussion in Matthew 15 and Mark 7 that dealt with ritual purity or lack thereof and the moral implications. Here we go. We're going to start off. We're quickly going to review the four questions. Concerning the one to be sent, as regards the Torah, the law of God, what was his primary purpose? Answer number one could be do away with the entire law. That was his primary purpose in coming, was to do away with the entire law of God. Second answer, do away with some of the law. Maybe the feasts, maybe the Sabbath, maybe the food laws and purity. That's what they believe here. Three, we could follow in the footsteps of the Mosaic prophecy in Deuteronomy 18, 15 and 18, which says that Yeshua, the Anointed One, will have a prophetic ministry. The Anointed One will have a prophetic ministry, and a prophetic ministry in Tanakh is about bringing Israel back to correct obedience to Torah. And this Anointed One's going to have that. And there's other things there too. And finally, number four, untangle the oral tradition from the written Torah, which includes helping the then Israelites and leaders to move toward a more correct understanding of what the Most High desires in His children as they walk out their lives. We've gone through this show after show. I'm just moving past that. The only point I want to bring up is this. Once you choose one of those for your answer, you create a filter in your mind, and everything you read in the Torah, the writings, the prophets, the apostolic writings, and beyond. Everything you read goes through that filter. So if you were to choose the filter that the primary mission of the one sent was to do away with the entire law, then every single time you read even a partial part of a sentence, there will be a temptation because of the filter to yank it out of the context of first century Judaism in the Second Temple period and put it in some other context to make it say what you want it to say to support that the primary purpose of the Anointed One was to come and to completely do away with the entire law of God. So you have to be careful with the creation of those filters. That's why it's good to have an assembly in which people can hold you accountable and you all can talk about it. You see that in 1 Corinthians 11, 18 and 19. All right, so let's move forward. There is a passage that Yeshua mentions, and it's in this section. We started with Matthew 5, 17, but this really ends at the end of chapter 7. It's a very long section. Some people refer to it as Sermon on the Mount, and that works. I want you to listen to these words. He says, enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the way that leads to life, and only a few find it. So if there is an organization, incorporated religious structure, that's membership is in the billions, then my question is, does that sound like the narrow gate, or does that sound like the wider gate? Just asking the question. In the context of first century Judaism, observing Torah, helping reform Judaism from within didn't work for the majority, or for many, didn't work for many. In that context, what does narrow road mean? Only a few find it. Something to consider as you create your filter. All right, so let's take a look now at Acts 24:5. This is approximately the year 57. Paul has been brought to Caesarea, and he's going to be tried before the governor of Judea, whose name is Felix. The high priest, and remember that the Pharisaic Judaism of the day, Paul was committed and subjected himself to their authority. They're holding court about some of the things that he's doing, and we've already talked about that. Proselyte ceremony is gone. Yeshua's understanding of ritual purity, we're not going to adopt oral tradition that extends that as a heavy yoke, and a number of other things. And Paul subscribes to that because that's a different way of thinking about these things. And he subscribes to it, and that comes out in the text. They're going to hold a trial because, as they say, he's a problem. Paul is a problem child. So we've got this court thing that's going to take place. The high priest and the elders come together and they hire an attorney. And his name is Tertullus. So you could say the lawyer for the prosecution was Tertullus, who spoke on behalf of Ananias, the high priest, and certain of the elders. Now here, let's just consider these things. He's the one who mentions the sect of the Nazarenes. Sect is heresis, and that means a different way of thinking about something, but it's translated, you have the different way of thinking about something of Pharisees and of Sadducees and the Zealots and the people who were around the Dead Sea and the people and Yeshuic and etc. So some people have submitted that, well, maybe he made this up. But here's the thing. Did you notice how quickly Paul subscribes to what he says? No hesitation. And he equates it with a well-established term that we're going to mention in a minute called the way. Then, too, the attorney is probably not going to create a term that the governor, Felix, has no idea what he's talking about. That's a good way to set yourself in a bad light with the judge. A term that is unknown and meaningless, and you use that to categorize the person who's on trial. Probably not. Probably not. As you read through chapter 24, and even in some of the other chapters as we move toward 28, an important note is that the Nazarenes was the name that was first applied to all followers of Yeshua. All followers. Because think about this. Paul's calling was to go to those who were not Jewish or proselytes. He was to go to the nations. And he did. By the time we get to 57, he's about to wrap this thing up. So he has established assemblies throughout Asia and perhaps other places. Rome was not one. They already had one. But he established these places going there, and there were some letters that were exchanged with some of them. And yet here, after all of that has been established, all of these perhaps even more Gentile than Jewish in some place assemblies, he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. That means that the Gentile believers who came in were of the sect of the Nazarenes. Everybody was called that. Now you might say, oh, wait a minute, no, they were called Christians. No, they weren't. We're going to get to that in just a moment. As a matter of fact, we're going to get to that right now. If you go through the apostolic writings, one of the things that you will discover is that people are never called Christian, period. That was not the name. Now, you're going to come back with, but wait a minute, what about Acts 11:26? Stay tuned. I have the answer for you, but let's work through this. A well-known scholar, James Dunn, Beginning from Jerusalem, Christianity the Making, Volume 2, he says that the believers were a messianic sect and that their most distinguishing feature was their beliefs regarding Yeshua, that as Messiah, the Anointed One, God had raised him from the dead and they identified themselves with him. So here we have, once again, the word sect, which is heresis in Greek, different way of thinking about something. A question was asked, what then of the meeting places of the first believers? Once again, from James Dunn's work. And his answer is, archaeology has uncovered no structure which can be both identified as a church and confidently dated earlier than a century or more beyond Paul. So let's say Paul makes it to 60, and I think he made it to 66, but let's just go with 60. No structure identified until at least 160. Wow, that's interesting. What happened to, they built the church just after Acts 2? I guess that didn't happen. So I wanted to find out a little bit more about this as the material comes across my desk. So I went to a book, Self-Designations and Group Identity in the New Testament, and the scholar's name I will spell Trebilco, which I think is Trebilco. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But he asked a couple of interesting questions. He says, what terms would early believers have used when they addressed one another? What would they have called each other? Would they have said, are you a Christian? Or are you a disciple? Or are you a believer? How would various believing groups have answered the question, who are we? How did authors refer to members of the communities to whom they were writing? And how would these members have referred to each other? This is from his book. Here's his list. Brothers and sisters. Brothers is the most frequently used term. Believers. Saints. The ecclesia, the assembly. No, the word for church, no, doesn't exist. Disciples. The way. And of course, Acts 24, we see the sect of the Nazarenes. But what about Christian? Nope, doesn't exist. Interesting. In section 1-3 of his book, that's really early on, it's obvious that when we discuss the earliest Christians, we need a designation to use. Until recently, Christian was the term that most scholars use. However, it is hard to avoid the charge of anachronism in the use of the term. That means it's out of time. Because the word Christian is never used in the apostolic writings in the first century as a self-designation. But, you say, what about Acts 11:26? Well, another scholar and archaeologist, Dr. Douglas Boyne, that's B-O-I-N, The Archaeological Quest for the Earliest Christians. This was written and published February 1st, 2018. Here's what he says. The race for the next spectacular artifact is on. The assumption seems to be that if we just look a little harder, if we just dig a little bit deeper, one day we'll find the one piece of evidence that will take us back to the earliest age of Yeshua and his followers. To many, it's an urgent archaeological mission with profound implications for the history of the faith. And he says, just don't hold your breath. For almost 200 years after the crucifixion, Roman cities are entirely devoid of any trace of early Christians. Yikes. To date, no one has ever found any object that's been plausibly connected to them. But you say again, Acts 11:26, and the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch, Christianus. The title Christianus and Roman Imperial Cult, listen to this statement. The name Christians presupposes Jewish expectation of the Messiah because Christos, Mashiach, the oiling, an expectation which had political implications. The proclamation of Yeshua as Messiah in the Jewish community of Antioch occasioned violent disorder in the city in the years 39 and 40. That's from the Roman records. The followers of the Messiah, or Christos, called Christiao, for the first time by the Roman authorities at Antioch, were blamed for the unrest. The name was thenceforth synonymous with sedition and crime. So the better translation of the Greek word with the Latin suffix is, this was the first place that they were called enemies of the state. Yeah, we got to look at that. You're right. All right, so getting back to our Acts 24:5, we need to take stock of the situation. There were Jewish bishops, 15 in all, take you into the second century. Then they were replaced with Gentile bishops, and things begin to change. There's history there. One of the things had to do with the fact that Bar Kokhba removed those Jews who believed in Yeshua. We have to go over that. And then Polycarp and Polycrates as two examples of bishops in Asia, all of them were still keeping the commandments, as we were seeing from their writings in the second century. And Netzarim, the sect of the Nazarenes, was still in combat with Rabbinic Judaism. So I'd like to go into a lot more detail about that because it's quite the fascinating read, and we will. But today I'm just connecting evidence that supports our understanding of what took place in Matthew 15 and Mark 7. Doesn't have anything to do with getting rid of clean and unclean. Doesn't have anything to do with getting rid of ritual purity or purity in general. It has to do with dealing with the problem of the oral tradition that had got out of hand, which we covered. I have to jump now from the first century to the fourth century, fifth century. We're going to read a little bit from an early church father, Epiphanius. He has Panarium 29, and I'm just going to cover a few aspects. We've already looked at this from Jerome's letter number 75 with Augustine, but now I'm coming up with another early church father. We'll get to Jerome in a moment. Here's what he says. They are succeeded by the Nazarenes. They did not give themselves the name of Christ, but they called themselves Nazarenes. We discovered that this man is a pest, somebody disturbing the people, the leader of the heresy of the Nazarenes. This is what he writes. We know where that comes from, Acts 24:5. The apostle did not deny this name. And he says, I admit to you that I serve God in the way which they call a heresy, which they call a different way of thinking about interpreting Torah, believing everything which is written in the law and the prophets. So the Torah still stood, but there was more than one way to interpret certain things. The early church father goes on to say, therefore, persons were called Nazarenes who came to believe in Christ, of whom it was written that he will be called a Nazarene. That's in Matthew 2:23. He goes on to say, these individuals remained wholly Jewish and nothing else, for they used not only the New Testament, but also the Old, like the Jews. For the legislation and the prophets and the scriptures, which are called the Bible by the Jews, are not rejected by them. They are not at all mindful of other things, but live according to the preaching of the law as among the Jews. There is no fault to find with them apart from the fact that they have come to believe in Christ. For they also accept the resurrection of the dead, and that everything has its origin in God. They proclaim one God and his Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. They have a good mastery of the Hebrew language. For the entire law and the prophets and what is called the scriptures, I mention the poetical books, Kings, Chronicles, Esther, and all the others, are read by them in Hebrew, as is the case with the Jews, of course. Only in this respect they differ from the Jews and Christians. Remember, this is 4th century. With the Jews, they do not agree because of their belief in Christ. With the Christians, because they are trained in the law, circumcision, the Sabbath, and other things. Then he goes on to talk about other things that they believed, and we're just going to move quickly over that. And here's the summary of what he wrote. They use both the Old and New Testaments. They have a good knowledge of Hebrew, read the Old Testament and the book of Matthew in Hebrew. They believe in the resurrection of the dead. They believe that God is the creator of all things. They believe in one God and his Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. They believe the Torah of Moses. They had their origin from the Jerusalem congregation, which fled to Pella before AD 70. And they are hated and cursed by the Jews. That's a quick picture and overview. Now, going to Jerome, in his works, he has collected commentary writings of the sect of the Nazarenes past the first century. And so I want to speak to one so that you can see where we're going as we relate to the issues of Matthew 15 and Mark 7. And this is their commentary on Isaiah 9:1-4. Here's what it says. The Nazarenes, whose opinion I have set forth above, try to explain this passage in the following way. When Christ came and his preaching shone out, the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, first of all, were freed from the eras of the scribes and the Pharisees. And he shook off their shoulders the very heavy yoke of the Jewish traditions. Later, however, the preaching became more dominant. That means the preaching was multiplied through the gospel of the Apostle Paul, who was the last of all the apostles. And the gospel of Christ shone to the most distant tribes and the way of the whole sea. Finally, the whole world, which earlier walked or sat in darkness and was imprisoned in the bonds of idolatry and death, has seen the clear light of the gospel. There are multiple quotes by the Netzarim in their interpretation of Isaiah, just like Yeshua used Isaiah 29, and they talk about these things. Now, they recently found within the last 100 years, well, maybe a little bit more, maybe 1905, 1908, they have found a writing in the second century in which you see the debates talking about the problem of extending ritual purity beyond what Torah requires, and you see the Netzarim interfacing and combating verbally rabbinic Judaism, and they take the position that they've missed it. They have completely missed it. This particular document, which is called the Gospel of the Savior, and it is an analysis of POXY 840. And it's by a scholar. His name is Michael Kruger. And we will be soon going through his discussion about that and its relationship to the Netzarim. I'm out of time. I would love to quote 28 pages of that text as he breaks down the details that go with exactly what Yeshua addressed in Matthew 15 and Mark 7, but we're just out of time. So I'm going to leave it at that, and then with the show coming up soon, we will address that thoroughly, but I am going to provide you with the entire book as a PDF. It's available on the website. All you have to do is download it. So I'm going to end here, and we're going to show up on the other side of the half hour and deal with the millennial kingdom, the seventh day. Thank you. Next up on our list of items that we want to discuss in relationship to Matthew 15 and its parallel passage, Mark 7. We're going to take up a discussion of the millennial kingdom. Now, this is a very large subject, and I just want to specify right from the beginning here that we live in the sixth day, and that the millennial kingdom is the seventh day, and then, well, then comes the eighth day. And you can look at that throughout the Tanakh. It's in Torah, Writings, and Prophets. You can start at Leviticus 23, and you notice that after the Feast of Tabernacles ends, there's a single one-day feast, and it's called the eighth day. It's quite a large subject. It'll be taken up at some future date. But for now, we're going to focus on the millennial kingdom. And this is the time period in which Yeshua comes back and reigns over the earth. I'm not going to get into the theological yeses and nos about this, but we're going to talk about it from the standpoint that we understand the prophecies in a literal sense. If they're completely allegorical, then that would change how our understanding is. But I'm not sure that that's the case. We're going to approach it from the literal standpoint, and we're going to look at a number of verses, and some of them will specifically speak to the text that we've been studying, which is the NIC-NT and their position on understanding Matthew 15 and its relationship to Torah and ritual purity. And you're going to see that there's another conflict. So let's get started. I have to open with a slight review of the millennial kingdom. There are things that you have heard about the seventh day. And of course, within the cycle that we live, according to Yeshuic Judaism, and this would apply to Rabbinic Judaism and Karaite Judaism as well, even today, there are 6 days that you can work, but the seventh day is Shabbat. This is the day that you rest. So the millennial kingdom is to some degree like that and is spoken of in a similar fashion. Once again, big subject. We're going to give the review and then we're going to focus on the pieces that are specific to what we're understanding and not understanding, which has to do with ritual purity, clean and unclean, and things of that sort. So I'm just going to blow by a couple of verses here you've probably heard of. In Isaiah 2:4, it says, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift sword against nation, and they will no longer study warfare." That's a pretty interesting statement. It's talking about an age that certainly is not today. For example, there are some who believe that the millennial kingdom started the destruction of the second temple. Nations will not lift up sword against nation. I'm not seeing that, at least during that 1,000 years. So the millennial kingdom would go from 70 AD to 1070, and no nations would lift up arms against another nation. So clearly that viewpoint has a problem. But Isaiah 2:4 does have that great passage there, and that is even other nations have taken this and used it as an ideal. And I think it is. It's great. Of course, that's going to require people being changed into the image of the Most High. Another subject. Okay, but I want to read another one too. Once again, this is one that you've probably heard. This is from Isaiah 11:6-9. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion together. A little child will lead them. This is good stuff. This is good stuff. Infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. That's Isaiah 11:6-9. You can see that it's talking about a special time, and that time has not come as of yet. Here we are in the 21st century. We are almost 2,000 years past the resurrection and ascension of Yeshua, and it has not happened yet, according to all of the prophecies. Now, there are some who will say, well, the prophecies are not going to be fulfilled. So in other words, their position is that There's quite a few prophecies about the millennial kingdom, but none of them are going to happen because the Jews, they misbehaved. And so the great Jewish experiment was canceled by God, and he sent one who would come and do away with the whole law and blah, blah, blah. Nah, not buying that. Sorry. Not buying that. I also want to mention that the millennial kingdom is also understood within rabbinic Judaism. And of course, rabbinic Judaism included the people who protested the oral tradition. And I'm not talking about Yeshuic Judaism and those people. We've talked about that some. I'm talking about several centuries after they finished writing down all the oral tradition, a group called the Karaites broke away because they didn't support that the oral tradition was what the people said it was. So there's been people throughout the centuries who've had a problem with it. So when I say that rabbinic tradition in the first century and second century, third century, the Karaites was still a part. They had not protested and requested reform at that time that I'm aware of. So over the centuries, there were writings. And one of those is by Maimonides, who's a famous Torah scholar. And he wrote, "And at that time there will be no hunger or war, no jealousy or rivalry, for the good will be plentiful and all delicacies available as dust. The entire occupation of the world will be only to know God. The people Israel will be of great wisdom." And he goes on. And he mentions also the Isaiah 9 passage we just read. So there's an understanding about this millennial kingdom. And like I said, I don't want to get into the weeds about the different theological positions, but it goes without saying that throughout Torah writings and prophets, there are statements that talk about an age to come, a prophet after Moses who will come, the establishment of a kingdom. We're going to take a look at some of those passages, and believe it or not, it talks specifically about what we are addressing. But I just want to give you a little bit of background there. So now I want to give you a little bit more of a background, and this will be based on some statements that were made by Yeshua and by others, like the disciples, and then they were called, and so that made them apostles. And these statements were understood within Judaism because later on it was recorded within Talmud, similar to the things that were said. So let me get into that so that we can go ahead and firmly establish our foundation of what we're talking about. It has been understood that there is a Messiah ben Yosef and a Messiah ben David. And so Joseph, as you know, there was a suffering period before he was set second, with only Pharaoh being above him. And then there's David, Messiah ben David, and all those prophecies. Well, Judaism understood that. There was always the concept of the kingly Messiah who will come to rebuild the temple. And we're going to talk a little bit about that rebuilt temple. It's detailed in Ezekiel. We're going to go through that at the end of this discussion. This whole thing, though, once again, was talking about ushering world peace and glorifying Israel as a spiritual head among all the nations. And you're going to see that when I quote Acts 1. The disciples are talking to Yeshua, and this is after the resurrection, but before his ascension, and they had a question about Israel being the head of the nations, which has been prophesied throughout Tanakh. So you'll see that in Acts chapter 1. But here's the thing. Yeshua was Messiah ben Yosef and David, but he did not fulfill all of the parts of the Davidic side. So as some people you've heard them say, when he returns, he will establish the fallen house of David. Well, that began in Acts 15. You saw it mentioned as having happened, rebuild the tabernacle of David. Yaakov, James, first KJV people, mentioned that. He was quoting a number of scriptures that dealt with that subject. And so he was explaining how it's begun. It has now officially begun. That's what he was stating in that meeting. All right, so let's keep going. When Yeshua returns, he will establish not only the fallen house of David, but he will punish lawlessness and teach Torah to the nations. This was their understanding. He will have full authority during that time period which was 1,000 years. And, you know, there's a saying about 1,000 years is a day. And once again, don't want to get into all of that. 1,000 years are clearly mentioned in Revelation, and we're going to look at that passage as well. In the Babylonian Talmud, in Sanhedrin 98b, it says, "The Holy One, blessed be He, will raise up another David for us, as it is written, but they shall serve Yahweh their Elohim and David their king, whom I will raise up unto them. Not I raised up, but I will raise up." So here, they understood that there was one that was going to be raised up that was going to accomplish these things. And they recorded that when they put down in writing their oral tradition. Now, here's another interesting passage that relates to the oral tradition as well. In Matthew 13, 16, 7, Yeshua is talking to his disciples, and he says, "Blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. For truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it." Where did that come from? Was that something that Yeshua made up? Well, the oral tradition about that already existed in the first century. It was later codified in the Babylonian Talmud in Shabbat 63d. Here's what it says. "All the prophets prophesied only for the days of the Messiah, but as for the world to come," that's what we're talking about in this segment, "eye hath not seen." Now, either the rabbis got it from Yeshua, or Yeshua knew about that oral tradition and used it when he spoke to the disciples, that eye has not seen. So I thought that that was a solid thing to bring to our attention too, the relationship between Yeshua, the disciples, the oral tradition in the first century of the Second Temple Judaism time period. Now that statement takes into account both appearances of the Mashiach, and that's important, Ben Yosef and Ben David. Now what about the identity in the prophecy? If you go to Genesis 49, and if you remember early on several episodes back, we talked about Genesis Rabbah and how it talked about they expected that the Messiah would come and help them see errors in their interpretation. And that's exactly what Yeshua did. Now, I'm not saying everybody received what he said, but they wrote down that that's what they understood the Messiah would do. So let's take a look at this. Genesis 49:10, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people." So how did the rabbis understand Shiloh? They write in the Midrash Rabbah 98:8, "Unto him shall be the obedience of the people. The Messiah will come and set on edge the teeth of the nations of the world." Getting really close to that Revelation 20 passage. Continuing with Lamentations Rabbah 151, it is stated, "King Messiah, whether he be of those still living or of those who are dead, bears the name of David." Well, what was the question Yeshua asked of the rabbis from Psalm 110, verse 1? Once again, they understood this, that we're not talking about something that's like a great mystery here. This was already within the consciousness of the first century Judaism. With one more quote, this is a Midrash on Psalm 2, and it says, "The sufferings are divided into three parts, one for David and the fathers, one for our own generations, and one for the King Messiah. And this is what is written, he was wounded for our transgressions. And when the hour comes, says the Holy One, blessed be He, to them, I must create him a new creation. This day have I begotten you." All of this is within the rabbinic Judaic oral tradition recorded, and these things took place in Tanakh, and Yeshua was talking about it. And so right here, there seems to be an understanding about the relationship of Yeshua and Isaiah's 53 prophecy about a suffering servant Want to talk about a large subject? That is a large subject. Anyhow, that's just a little bit of background about the concept of King Messiah coming once. Remember, John asked, are you the one or do we look for another? In other words, are you the one who's going to be Messiah ben Yosef, and do we look for another who's going to be Messiah ben David? And it turns out that he's going to do both. They didn't expect that, and John asked the question, and he got it answered. So, as you can see, there are some pretty well understood thoughts about the matter. And there's so many verses that could be gone through. So I just want to go through enough so that you can see what points directly to our argument that the author and commentary writer of NICNT talking about the dismissing of clean and unclean and ritual purity and those matters therein, I believe he's missed the mark. And we're going to continue. I'm going to start now with Acts 1. As I said, this is the time period. Yeshua has risen from the dead, but he has not ascended yet. So the disciples, knowing the prophecies, and you can see that scattered through their work, their writings, Acts also records some of that. They gather around him in verse 6, chapter 1. It says, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? They understood what the prophecy said. Now look at his answers. He says, it is not for you to know the time or dates. So at this time, it's almost like the wedding. From the wedding standpoint, that which is going to be built to house the new couple is built, and when it's ready, then the bride is sent for. But there's no time set for that. It's when it's ready. So here, Yeshua says to them, it's not for you to know the times or the dates that the Father has set by his own authority. So does he say, oh, come on, man, we're not going to restore Israel like the prophet said? He doesn't say that there. He says there are dates that have been set by the Father that relate to this. It's not for you to know them at this time. For whatever reason, it's not for you to know at this time, but the Father has set them by his authority. So here we are. Are you going to restore the kingdom of Israel? The Father has set the time by his own authority for that, but I cannot communicate that to you at this time. And so then he finishes up with receiving power. The Holy Spirit comes upon you. You'll be witnesses in Jerusalem. That's the Greek word is martyrs there. Judea, Samaria, ends of the earth. So what do we have? We have a level of recognition. The Father has said it. It's in his own authority, but it's not going to be today. So he did not tell them. He just let them continue to move on. Okay, so now we're going to move on. In Revelation chapter 20, starting at verse 1, it says, I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss, and holding in his hand a great chain. He seized the dragon, who is the devil, or Satan, and bounding for 1,000 years. That's interesting, bounding for 1,000 years. Threw him into the abyss, and locked and sealed it over him. Notice he's not being thrown into the lake of fire. The other two were thrown into the lake of fire, beast and false prophet. Satan is not thrown into the lake of fire at this time. He's thrown into something else so that he cannot go out and deceive the nations until the 1,000 years have ended. So that's a discussion. We bring that up and talk about in detail on the eighth day. But here in verse 3, he's put into the abyss. And then 4, I saw thrones and souls who were obedient. They had not worshipped the beast or its image or received the mark. They came to life, reigned with Christ 1,000 years. That's what the text says. Now, if we don't want to believe in a millennium, we'll just cancel the book of Revelation. That would be pretty easy. 5, the rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy are those who share in the first resurrection. This is the resurrection. This is the harvest of the first fruits. 1 Corinthians 15:20-28, but mostly 20-23, pinpoint this exact thing. When Yeshua comes, he will raise those who are his. That would be the first fruits. 6, blessed and holy are those who share in this resurrection. The second death has no power over them, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. So if you're reigning, that is an administrative judicial position. So that's more there that goes along with that type of thing. Now let's run over to Zechariah 14. It says, this is talking about the Great Tribulation. Then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year. Who's going up? Then all the survivors from all the nations that attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, Yahweh Elohim, and to celebrate the Festival of Tabernacles. Oh, so we did away with it for a while, but now we're bringing it back again. Mm-hmm. If any of the peoples of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, Yahweh Elohim, they will have no rain. If the Egyptian people do not go up and take part, they will have no rain. Yahweh will bring on them the plague he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Festival of Tabernacles. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Festival of Tabernacles. So here is a festival. They're talking about after the tribulation, those who survive it and go in as regular humans, not from a resurrection standpoint, but regular humans, are required to go up. If they don't go up, then they get punished. That's interesting. That's quite interesting, I would say. All right, so let's run over to Ezekiel and look at that. In Ezekiel 40 to 48, that is 9 chapters, there is a discussion about the temple of the millennial kingdom. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at a passage that is there, and it is in Ezekiel 45:17, and this is what it says. It shall be the prince's part to give burnt offerings, meat offerings, drink offerings in the festivals, the new moons, and the Sabbaths, all of the Moedim of the house of Israel. So that's addressing that, and you'll remember that in Colossians 2:16-17, it says the same thing. Let no one judge your eating and drinking as regards holy days, new moons, or the Sabbath, which are a shadow of things to come. The only people who can judge is those who are part of the body of Messiah. Same phraseology. That's pretty good. So if we continue in Ezekiel 45, what you will see at 21 is in the first month, the 14th day of the month, you'll have the Passover and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread, 7 days. And then you move to 25, 7th month, 15th day of the month, do like in the Feast of 7 days. So you have all that stuff happening right there. Now, here's the part that is important to us. We're going to drop back one chapter from 45 and look at 44, 23 and 24. This is what it says. They will teach my people the difference between the holy and the common and show them how to discern between the clean and the unclean. Wow. So if it was done away, I guess it's been brought back again. In any dispute, they shall officiate as judges and judge according to my ordinances. They must keep my Torah and statutes regarding all my Moedim. That's the appointed feast, and they must keep my Sabbath holy. So here we see that we're keeping the festivals, we're keeping Shabbat, holy, profane, clean, unclean, everything is back in place. If what we understand about the millennial kingdom is true, as you can see, it's all here. Thank you.